Blog Talk Radio.
And I got the HD blues, and my life feels kind of rough. Baby, I won't ever, ever give up. You might see me moving.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Help for HD Live. Help for HD Live is brought to you by Help for HD International and is made possible by our sponsors, Teva Pharmaceuticals and the Griffin Foundation. I am your host, Katie Jackson, and today our guest is Dr. Peg Napolis. Dr. Napolis is a psychiatrist that works with patients that have HD and JHD. There are several observational studies and clinical trials that are being conducted at the University of Iowa. The JHD observational study are the Kids HD and the Kids JHD programs are those conducted by Peg Napolis's laboratory. I'm super excited to have Peg on with us. We were actually able to go to Iowa this year and bring a hype day, and we are really excited this year to have symposium in Iowa. Iowa, you would think it's doing amazing things, and the team over there is amazing, and we love everyone from Iowa, so we're super excited to have Dr. Napolis on with us today. So I'm going to bring her into the show and let her talk and tell us a little bit about herself. So thanks, Peg, for being on the show.
Thank you, Katie.
Yeah, and so let's start and just talk about a little bit about your background and how you and why you became involved with Huntington's disease.
Sure. So I'm a psychiatrist. I did all of my training here at the University of Iowa, and I got trained in addition in brain imaging. So I actually started my work in schizophrenia many years ago, but probably about 13 years now, I began working in the clinic to see patients with Huntington's disease. And so that really began for me a change in the focus of both my clinical skills as well as my research. And the first thing I became involved in is the big PREDICT study. So the imaging portion of that large study, which was a multi-site study of pre-HD subjects. And then after that, I became involved in the programs that we have in my lab, which is the Kids HD and the Kids JHD. And I continue to see every patient that comes through our HD Center of Excellence, and also to testing for our neurogenetics clinic. So when we have people who are at risk for Huntington's coming into our protocol, and I'm involved in that, which is, I think, one of the most interesting things I've ever done as a clinician. So both clinically and research-wise, my focus over the past 13 years has been very specifically Huntington's disease, and I feel both blessed and lucky to be able to work in both realms.
Mm-hmm. And can you explain to us a little bit about how your clinic there, because you guys are kind of unique that you guys have multiple teams working with HD. So can you explain to us about the University of Iowa clinical work?
Yeah, you know, when we started so long ago, initially it was very much just kind of a research assessment. But when I started, I wanted to do actual clinical care. I wanted to take care of the patients and help them and treat them medically. And so we started to make it more actual medical treatment rather than just the research. But it took a little bit of time. And so it initially started out with just the psychiatrist and the neurologist. But then we, of course, added the neuropsychologist. There had always been, because this was a center of excellence, a social worker. And then probably maybe about 8 years ago or so, we added genetic counseling, which has, for the most part, been our clinic coordination, but also in terms of our ability to provide the pre-symptomatic genetic testing. The genetic counselors are an important part of that. And over time, we've just grown and grown. I mean, we're a rural state, but because I think of how well we've done, we've gotten more and more patients. And just 2 years ago, we actually expanded to the point where we needed an additional team. And because it's multidisciplinary, I mean, it's not like we just got an additional neurologist. We got an additional team. So we have a whole other team that is a neurologist, a psychiatrist, a neuropsychologist, another genetics counselor. And the social worker is actually the one of the only few people that actually go between the two. So we call them Team N, which is Team New, and Team Old, which is me and Dr. Cam Holst, and not necessarily just because we're old, we kind of are, but we're also the original team that was there. But it's been awesome to be able to expand so that the number of patients that we've had have just increased so much that the demand, said that we needed to up the ante. So we've been able to do that, and it's been great.
Yeah, yeah. Dr. Cam Holst, I saw him, of course, when I was in Iowa, but I just saw him in Colorado at HSG meetings, so I was able to say hi to him real quick. Yeah. So how many patients with HD are seen at the University of Iowa, and how many children with HD do you guys see?
Yeah, well, there's two separate things. So the patients that we see in clinic, and that would probably include also the people that come in for neurogenetics clinic. There's probably about 180 visits per year, and those are people, that's unique visits. If people live close enough to us, they'll come back and get their care here. A lot of patients will come, they'll drive a distance, and they will have their primary person, their primary neurologist or their primary physician take care of them, and then they come once a year, and we are, consultation. So out of that, nearly 200, like I said, some of them are seen frequently and some of them are seen once a year. Now, out of that, the number of people who are children is pretty small. First of all, because some of our children are seen in our pediatrics movement disorder clinic. But we also have a research protocol in my lab where we bring in to the research protocol kids from all over the country. And in general, because JHD is about 5 to 10% of all HD. If you take everyone who's diagnosed with Huntington's disease, only about 5 to 10% of them are going to be people that developed it below the age of 21. So there's obviously a smaller number of those. But remember too, of course, the people who develop it young will eventually, become adults too. So there's certainly a number of people that we have in our clinic who are young adults, but they have been, diagnosed earlier than 21, so they are actually JHD, but they're simply now adults.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting what you just said, and you made me think of something. My husband has a high CAG of 49, and when he got diagnosed, he got diagnosed at 25, but looking back, my mother-in-law and I can find symptoms or things that when he was much younger, things that were different. So the JHD thing has always been kind of an interesting thing to me because I feel, and this is just an observation being a patient advocate, obviously I have no medical background, but I feel like people may get it in their youth or when they're younger, but we don't actually identify it and diagnose it till they're older. So it's an interesting fine line, right? Between
It's a very fine line because the diagnosis is made specifically on motor symptoms, and you can have a lot of subtle motor symptoms that come on and can potentially be there for years before they become, significant enough for a neurologist to say, these are abnormal enough. This crosses the threshold for diagnosis. And that's just motor symptoms. We certainly know that before motor, you can get behavior changes and thinking changes in some people that are, years and years before any motor symptoms come on. So there's certainly, you know, it's a long progression, and in the early years, it's subtle and sometimes missed. And just like you said, it's oftentimes in retrospect, people go, okay, now I see that looking back, and it kind of makes sense that it was probably, you know, all part of that. But at the time,
right,
when it presents, it sometimes it doesn't present very dramatically because it's a slow, subtle change over time. And in particular for family members who are, you know, seeing their loved ones every day, sometimes it's a little bit harder to appreciate changes until enough time has gone by where you go, okay, that's clearly different.
Right. And I think the interesting thing is so many of those early symptoms, we can just think that that's just part of childhood or adolescence, like clumsiness or something like that. So it's like, it's so hard because, you know, you don't want to say, oh, my child's clumsy, they have JHD or they have Huntington's for sure, because children are clumsy, right? But
right,
then you look back and you're like, oh, my mother-in-law noticed out of having four children, Mike the only one at risk, the only one from his father, that he was dramatically more clumsy than her other children and dropped things more and stuff. And so was that HD or was that just he was just clumsy? Who knows, right? We'll never know.
Yeah.
But,
very difficult to know.
It's interesting. Yeah. I know that you have a lab that you oversee at UI. Can you tell us about some of the different research programs that are being conducted for HD?
Sure. The first one, which is the largest one, is the Kids HD program. And this is for children. We've actually expanded it to include young adults. So it's anybody from age 6 to 25 who have a parent or a grandparent with Huntington's disease. So they're at risk. And certainly the ones that are below 18 are, of course, untested because we can't test below the age of 18. And we're interested in this study in evaluating how the gene affects brain development. So we want to see children, and we want to see what the gene does for brain development. So everyone comes to Iowa. It's only one site, so we fly people in or train. It's mostly flight. Some people drive. And then the assessment that we do is, you know, we do cognitive testing, so thinking skills. We do motor testing. We get an MRI scan, and we do get DNA. Now, the DNA is processed to count the CAG repeats in the gene, and that will determine whether or not the gene is expanded or non-expanded. So that will determine whether, you know, that child is going to develop Huntington's or not. Now, really importantly, that information is blinded, meaning that the family doesn't get that information, the participant doesn't, not even our lab members. We don't get that information. And so it's for research purposes only. Now, someone who is, because we increased the age from 18 to 25, if you've already participated in pre-symptomatic testing, you know, you can still participate. But no matter what, even if you're over 18 and you come to the program, we don't release the results because it's just a research program. All of the information is just for research only. But it gives us the opportunity, it's such a unique opportunity, to look at the development of the brain in the context of people who have the gene expansion. Because one of the questions is, are there early signatures? I mean, we knew from the PREDICT study that adults, and the average age for a person in the PREDICT study was about 40, but we could see that 10, 15 years before onset of symptoms, there were already brain changes. So that led us to think that maybe if we even looked further, how about 20 or 30 years? How about, you know, the 12-year-old who's going to develop Huntington's as a 50-year-old, do they have changes in their brain that are related to the gene expansion? And so it's been a very exciting study. It's been funded by the government, by the National Institutes of Health, and we're going on our 10th year. We're just finishing up 10 years of study, and it took us quite a while to get started, as you can imagine. But I think one of the things that's been really important for us is that the HD community, certainly in the past decade, has had a huge, you know, coming of age of children at risk for HD. So the development of the, of, you know, the NYA and the HDO, and I mean, there's been such a better organization and opportunities for children to get involved, and so that's actually, you know, helped our program as well. And so we feel really lucky and privileged that we've seen, you know, now hundreds of families, and we follow them longitudinally. They come, they get assessed, and they come back sometimes, you know, two or three times. I think we've had one person that's come back now five times. And in general, we have them come back every 1 or 2 years. Mm-hmm. The second program is actually a little bit, it's similar, but it's specifically for kids who are already sick. So that's the kids JHD. So the kids who have already been diagnosed, they've already had their gene test, and they've already had symptoms. Remember, the kids at risk, the vast majority of them, I mean, they're years from onset. But if we have somebody who's already been diagnosed, we want to understand that as well, because that is, you know, the extreme version of adult onset. We're the first study ever to do a JHD study, actually. All of the literature on JHD, all of it, is either what we call case reports, so one or two people, or case series, where you kind of go back in time and you look at the medical records of people. This is the only study in the world that looks at JHD kids over time with brain imaging. And so it's a really
important,
unique study. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that one is more rare, so there's not nearly as many kids in that protocol, but it's the same thing where they come in and they have the same assessments. They get an MRI scan, they get cognitive testing, they get motor testing. They're able to see clinicians here who are specialized in JHD, and then, of course, the brain MRI scan.
Right. And a lot of things that I think that the really important thing about this study is that, you know, when you go to the NIH website or you go to any of these websites and you're reading about symptoms of a disease, right, when any of us think about a disease, we can go to the NIH, pull it up, and then it shows symptoms and about the disease. Well, with something like JHD, like you were saying, there's just case studies. So how do you know two subjects that you're watching, you know, they're going to be very different. There's like really rare symptoms in JHD that we all know through listening to the mothers, right? Like the itching, the sleep disturbance. Of course, we all know about the seizures. So this is such an important study, I think, because of just from the data that can be turned into publications. So these parents' voices can be heard when they're screaming out loud, "My child itches all night," and a doctor looks at them and says, "Well, that's not something that happens." Well, how do you have all these mothers say it happened, but there is no literature or publications backing them up?
It is, yeah.
Well,
you know,
I'm
sorry to cut you off, but in the age in particular of social media, so we do have a publication that's coming out, and of course you guys were so vital in helping this. Denise Hedgel was somebody who was really key in helping us identify this issue of being able to use the community, because it's a very, you know, it's a high-level community who communicate a lot, but they communicate amongst themselves, and we were able to tap into that, and we provided a survey that we identified. We focused on specific symptoms that we had heard from participants who have JHD, and we focused on what we would call kind of unusual symptoms that had not been, you know, listed anywhere in the literature. So the itching that you mentioned was certainly one. Sleep disturbance. I mean, we see sleep disturbance in adult onset, but not to the level that we see it in the kids. Pain, pain is huge for JHD, not something that we deal with very often at all in the adult onset. Tics, so tics are a unique movement that are not typically what you see in adult onset. So the difference is that chorea means dance-like. So the movements of adult onset are more fluid and dance-like. And a tic is more a little bit almost like a tremor. It's rhythmic. So, you know, a tic is like a blinking of your eye or, you know, it can be vocal like that, like clicking of your tongue. And tics are typically seen more likely in juvenile than in adults. And then the last one we looked at was psychosis, looking at hallucinations or delusions, which is a fixed false belief. And when we tapped the JHD community about, does your child with JHD have these symptoms and how often are they and how severe are they, we were just really blown away at how prevalent they were and how, you know, how much suffering there was specifically with these, what we ended up calling, you know, uncommon, you know, but significant symptoms. And we do. We have a publication that's just about ready to come out. I think it might already be out online regarding that. And I think it should be helpful just because it is something now that's in the literature that families can, you know, potentially take to their physician just to at least acknowledge that, yes, this is something that other kids with JHD have. Now, the one thing we don't have information on is, you know, how has it helped? You know, we had a lot of parents write in, you know, what they had tried, but there isn't really any consistent, you know, information about what would be the best treatment for pain or what's the best treatment for itching. So that was one thing that we really didn't have enough information on in the survey. But I think it empowers families to at least, you know, educate their, you know, because the JHD families are the experts, right? Even when they have physicians, they, you know, the families are the ones that the expert. But they can hand that to their physician and let that physician know that, yes, this is actually seen very commonly in this phenomenon.
Absolutely. And I think it also protects the mothers because I can't tell you over and over how many times I've heard that these moms have had put in their file that they are overprotective or even this Munchausen syndrome. And I mean, they literally are being targeted. Oh, yeah. I've heard it over from moms. I know Kinzer is one of the big ones that, you know, she went through hell and back with her hospital. Them not believing her, and then, you know, even bringing in CPS, and she speaks very openly about that. She spoke about it in our documentary, but and she's not the only one. I hear about this all the time, and so I think having literature to be able to bring into the hospital or the doctor and say, or even child protective services that says, look, I'm not a crazy overprotective or a Munchausen mother. This is what my child is experiencing. So my heart just goes out for these JHD moms because I just can't even imagine what they're going through. No one listens to them. People don't, you know what I mean? Except for amazing people like you guys and the University of Iowa and even UC Davis that have come together and really listened to these moms cry, you know, these moms' cries, but most people don't. And so, I think this is, I'm excited for this to come out. And I definitely, once it's out, I want to share it like crazy, so please let me know. And I want to make sure I get that to any family that has a child, that any family impacted by JHD. But let's talk about this study. How come these kind of programs are beneficial to future clinical trials?
Yeah, so let me break it up again to the two different studies. So for the Kids HD study, I think it's going to be really, really important. So everybody knows that, you know, we are on the precipice of gene therapy. We've started these trials. You know, it's been a long time coming. There's certainly a lot of hope that, you know, these are going to be important, you know, treatments for HD. And everyone knows that initially the treatment trials are typically for people who have already started the symptoms, but ultimately everyone has the same goal, which is prevention, right? So once we find a gene therapy that works, we're going to want to give it to people who are at risk before they start showing symptoms. Now, the question is, when do you give that? And how soon do you give it? And what are the potential risks for, you know, knocking down this gene? So the things that we have found in our study is that this gene, even when it's expanded, in the range of 40 to 44, it's actually good for brain development. We know that the Huntington gene itself is important in brain development. We know that because when we look at animal models, so what we do when we find a gene and we want to know, hey, what does this gene do? We actually take a mouse model and we, called knockout, we knock that gene out. So here's a mouse. It doesn't have the Huntington gene. What happens when that mouse has a baby without that gene? And when that happens, the babies don't live. They die. And what that means is that the Huntington gene is extremely important for development. And in particular, it's important for brain development. So the normal gene is important for brain development. And even when it's gene expanded in the low range, like 40 to 44. So that, and that's the information that we've gotten from our KidsHD study. And that's going to be important going forward when we decide when do we give the preventive gene therapy, because the brain actually takes a long time to completely mature. So we all know, you know, adolescence is a, you know, just a crazy time, right? The brain is changing dramatically. And what we call kind of late maturation, you can call it development, but it's, you know, late maturational process. Your brain is still changing until about age 25 and a little bit older if you're male.
Wow.
And so it takes such a long time for the brain to completely mature that since even this gene, when it's expanded, we need to be careful about when we knock it down, right? So because you don't want to knock it down when they're 15 because they're not done. Their brain isn't done growing yet. So I think that the KidsHD study is going to inform eventually once we get a gene therapy that we want to prevent disease onset, it'll help us inform when we give that. You know, so there'll be a time after brain. It's likely that, you know, for some people, if their CAG repeat is around 40 to 44, that we should wait until they're done developing before we give them the gene therapy. And then maybe for other kids who have a much longer CAG repeat, we might want to give it much earlier because even though they're still in brain development, since it's a very, very long CAG repeat, it's already causing some problems. So I think the Kids HD study is going to help in the timing of preventive therapy. For the JHD study,
which is imperative for the FDA, right? They're going to want to know
it
that.
It is.
That's another thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they're going to want to know that information and that data.
Right.
For sure.
Right. The other thing for JHD, so JHD is unique in that even though these kids are already sick, there's no studies for JHD. And, you know, there's a lot of adult trials going on, but, you know, nothing for JHD. And so it's really important to be ready when that comes down the pike, so because there needs to be, and there's a lot of good push forward to be including, you know, including JHD in clinical trials. Right now, for clinical trials like the gene therapy, we look at one of the things we use, it's called a biomarker, is the volume of your caudate or putamen. That's a region of the brain. They're both in the middle of your brain. And we get that volume from an MRI scan. And that's the region of the brain that's primarily affected with Huntington's. Huntington's eventually affects the whole brain, but it first starts out and affects most severely the caudate and the putamen. And we can see how the disease progresses by taking an MRI scan and looking at the volume of the caudate and putamen, because we can see that it normally, with the disease, it changes. So if you get a scan on year one, or at baseline, and then you take it 1 year later, if you have Huntington's, we can see that that change in the volume, it decreases. Now, the reason why we use that is because in a clinical trial, what we do is we give the drug at baseline, and then we can see at year one there's been no change. If there's been no change in the caudate and putamen, that means that drug is working. That means it's protecting the caudate and putamen from degenerating. So without that drug, it degenerates. So that's called a biomarker. So we use an MRI scan to take the volume of the caudate and putamen, and we track it over time. And that allows us to see if we intervene with the drug, you know, does that biomarker change? Does it show neuroprotection? In JHD, the volume of the striatum is already so small and so abnormal that it actually doesn't change an awful lot during a year period of time. But a different region of the brain does. So the cerebellum is a different region of the brain. It's the area in the back of the brain. And that area in JHD is, first of all, it starts out abnormally big. And then over time, it seems to get bigger over time. So it may be that in clinical trials, everybody who's doing a clinical trial now who's an adult onset, their biomarker in an MRI scan is the caudate and putamen. But that probably won't be useful for JHD because the caudate and putamen doesn't change so much. For JHD, the MRI biomarker may be the cerebellum. And our study suggests that is the case. And so that will be really important to know in terms of clinical trials for the JHD kiddos once they start, that we would be looking at a different area of the brain that changes with disease progression.
It's unbelievable. I mean, that kind of stuff is going to help the future of medicine for our community, and our JHD community for sure. Wow, that's interesting. I've heard that before, but I you know, it's always, I've heard it one other time, and it was like in passing during one of our programs, and I kind of went, what was that? And then now I'm like, oh my goodness, that's my problem. I never have time to sit and listen, but that is interesting. And now, will that be made is that data made public? Like, I mean, I know it's public because you talked about it, but is a lot of this coming out?
It is. Yeah. As a matter of fact, so I have a graduate student who is just writing up this data, and so we have a manuscript in preparation. So probably it'll be in formal print in the next few months, and it will be. And that will be just the first one, and that's actually just looking at the time one data. And then we also have the longitudinal data. So, but we'll be publishing that soon.
Wow. Okay, that's exciting. And currently, are there any clinical trials for HD taking place at ULI?
Sure. Yeah, there are. So there are several. So we have observational trials, but we also have some clinical trials as well. So, you know, one really unique one that we have here is an exercise intervention. So we have Dr. Vince Magnotta, who is our MR expert, and he's been working. He worked with me and Dr. Paulson in the PREDICT study for many years, and he got a small grant from the National Institutes of Health to look and see if people who are pre-HD and they are given an exercise regimen, so 3 days a week where they are exercising for, I think it's probably at least something like 40 minutes, does that help protect their brain from changing? And once again, it's that caudate and putamen. So it's an imaging protocol where at the beginning of the study they get an MRI scan, and then they start on their exercise program, and then we get an MRI afterwards, and then we see whether or not it's the same thing as if you would give a drug. So we would expect potentially the people who are exercising, over that period of time, their caudate putamen would not change as much as the people who weren't exercising, so that the exercise may be proven to be neuroprotective, so it would keep the caudate putamen from getting smaller. So that's one. It's a pretty unique study. We also have the Signal trial, which is an infusion trial, and that's actually a study that is now on the second cohort. So the first cohort, the results were, impressive enough to go ahead and do a second cohort, and that's a process that we're really excited about as well. And then, of course, we have, the KITS HD and the JHD protocols. And we also have Clarity. So the Clarity study is run by Ed Wild in the UK. And he is interested in looking in CSF, so cerebral spinal fluid, so getting a spinal tap to be able to look at the proteins in the fluid that surrounds the brain. So we'll be starting that study, and so that's in collaboration with Dr. Wild. And actually, we're collaborating with him, too, for the Kids HD study, because he's also evaluating a protein called neurofilament light, NFL. And it's a little protein that you can get actually not in CSF. You can get it in blood. And it seems once again, be like a biomarker. It seems to track disease progression. And we're collaborating with him so that he can maybe measure it in the Kids HD protocol, too. So that's one
that's
great
awesome.
Thing about the
Dr. Wild's
about the
great.
About the HD community is that it's, collaborative and people work together, which is exciting.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and it's exciting just to have all these different things going on for the community. So it's definitely a more promising time than it has ever been before. So I actually, this is more of a I don't know about a question, but more of a statement. You know, I know we went to the FDA a couple years ago and we spoke at the PDUFA meeting, and it's interesting because it makes you always wonder when you do something, a big project like this as a patient advocacy group, you wonder if it's making any impact. I don't know how you feel about that, but I don't know if you, I mean, I know you know we all went and spoke at that PDUFA meeting with the FDA, and I really hope that meeting will help JHD, because I think that is really a lot of our main mission in making that journey and that trip to across the country, some of us, to talk about JHD with them, because it would be really, I know pediatrics is just, it's hard to get pediatric studies and it's hard to get children in adult studies. So I hope they really listen to those JHD studies. I mean, JHD testimonies.
I'm positive they did. I mean, it was just, you can't listen, to those stories without having compassion and wanting to help. And they are, because every single story is tragic, of course. And, the devil's in the details, so to speak. But I certainly have, the idea and the feeling that there's a lot more discussion amongst investigators, amongst clinicians. I've had inquiries from pharmaceutical companies who are interested in doing JHD, and they're just starting to gather information. And so I think we're getting a lot more movement than we ever have before. I think it's encouraging and exciting.
Yeah, yes, me too. Well, thank you so much, Peg, for coming on the show with us today. I know you are super busy. As many people don't know, Peg is actually the director of the whole department now at the University of Psychiatry, right, Peg?
Yeah, interim chair, it's called. Yep. That means I'm temporary.
So she's
we're looking for a permanent chair.
Oh, no, you're incredibly special, and you are very busy, and we are so lucky anytime we get time with you, and we thank you for all that you are doing for our community, and all of you, and all of your whole team at University of Iowa, what you're doing for HD and JHD. We really appreciate all your work, and we enjoy any time we get to spend with you guys, and so we are excited this fall to come to Iowa for our big event, because Iowa, there's a lot going on. Who would have known Iowa? It's amazing.
Yeah,
things
who would
are
have thought
at Iowa?
This little cornfield. This little cornfield.
Yes,
but anyhow,
yes.
You know, so back at you, we've been so privileged as, you know, a group to, you know, be a part of the community and, you know, benefit from organizations like yours. I mean, truly, I mean, you know, with every visit and with every, you know, interactions, being able to discuss more and learn more and, you know, disseminate information and just being our advocate, which is really awesome, because obviously at a time, there was certainly a time where when we started, it was, you know, it was really hard to recruit just because it's a brand new study. It's on children. We're really vigilant
sure.
about the notion that, you know, children, you know, research on children has to be taken care, you know, really carefully. But we certainly appreciate, you know, all of your help for our studies as well.
Oh, yeah, we are here for you guys if you need anything. And we will come back soon for another update. It's been way too long since we've had you on the show. But thank you for taking the time. And to let everyone know, next week is Dr. Bonnie Hennig is coming on to talk to us a little bit about some ideas about our new normal going through the holiday season. We all know families impacted by HD and JHD. The holiday season is hard for us. And so Bonnie Hennig is going to come on and talk to us a little bit more about that, and maybe give us some ideas on how to make the holidays a little bit easier for our loved ones as well as us being caregivers. So that should be a great show. Until next week, everyone have a safe night, and we will talk to you next Wednesday.